Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, President Obama proposes to decimate part of the legacy of the 1960s war on poverty, and some employers have a policy of only offering jobs to people who already have jobs. But first, the National Nurses United Union has launched a new internet campaign called ProtestInTheUSA.com. The union's executive director, Rose Ann DeMauro, says the idea is to establish a clearinghouse for progressive political action in the United States.
For many, many years, the nurses have been out there basically raising the flag in terms of what's going on with healthcare in America. And we've been protesting hospitals, insurance companies on behalf of patients and trying to get the message across that healthcare is a human right in this country, or should be a human right in this country. And what we've seen is a systematic decline in terms of the social safety net for everyone. And so you see the corruption of the banking industry in terms of the horrible predatory loans that they did to people. You see mass unemployment. You see a level of discontent. And what we're seeing is protests are occurring, but I think internationally people think that Americans are essentially contented, and they're not. It's just this facade from Washington, D.C. that they were hoping to kind of perpetrate this mythology about America. I think there's mass discontent in America, and I think we are finally at the end of believing that the president, I think we put far too much faith. And this is why, in many ways, we started the protest in the USA to demonstrate the fact that people are angry in this country, and they are demonstrating, and they are protesting. And what we wanted to do is to give them a forum to post their protest, to show everyone else what's going on in terms of even small protest, you know, acts of, you know, a few individuals who are extremely unhappy with basic right-wing policies in this country. I think we're in a very different action phase in this country. It was, we all thought, you know, we all kind of worked on the Obama campaign thinking, you know, believing in the message of hope. Well, that's kind of run its course, and it was false consciousness on all of our part, because we should have been in motion. We shouldn't put our, you push your leaders. You don't expect them to be in the pit of Washington, D.C. and think that they're going to do anything really effective. I mean, in that sense, there's kind of a right-left coalition that has kind of lost faith in what happens in D.C. So you see in Wisconsin, you see a breakaway, you know, 10,000, 15,000 people in the streets. You see that in Ohio. You see that with nurses across the country. You see it with teachers. And I think we're going to see that more and more and more. And then it occurred to us that there's no real forum for everyone to share this information. So what we wanted to do is to give a home for protest to so people could communicate about the fact that there are protests, and then one day hopefully join these protests, and then to collectively act together to state our discontent. And we believe that that's coming faster than we would have otherwise thought. It's coming down the road really fast. There's just too much. There's been too many abuses. There's been too much discontent, and there's been too much. The country's been too quiet. Carnell West said the other night on Bill Maher's show that Obama has domesticated the left, and I'm inclined to agree with that. I think that there's been a lull of false consciousness, a sense of complacency, and what we want to do is to hopefully not only document protests, but inspire protests. People, if they're not protesting, they're not paying attention.
Yes, some of us have concluded that Obama has damn near neutralized the left. But how would this clearinghouse-type operation work?
Well, first of all, it's information, so people know that there are protests, and we're also going to tell people how to protest. I mean, a lot of people are very unhappy, want to do something, want to, you know, pick up a sign and let someone know, and we're going to say, you know, this is, you know, you just put your words on a piece of paper, you know, how you do this, you know, or, you know, there's a variety of ways to do this. So it's kind of, you know, we're going to do kind of like, you know, a guide to how to protest. And ultimately, this is something we're going to build, and we're going to build it collectively throughout this country. So, and it's a clearinghouse. You know, it's obviously not going to be for, you know, the politics of hatred from the right, but it's going to be for humanity, for, you know, social justice, and then people who are fighting back. And so we'll collect information from the various protests that are going on in the United States, and we're going to make it U.S. specific, because it seems that there has to be something that's stated very firmly that there is mass discontent in America, that people are speaking out and they are acting out, and that they will join collectively, and that what happened in Egypt is, you know, I mean, America's got a history of protest, and it's been buried and quelled with the neoliberal agenda in the last several years, and much more so under Obama, because it's our fault. It's, you know, you can say what you want in terms of what Obama has done, hasn't done himself a great service here, because he essentially has domesticated the left, and he's going to need the left, but he thinks that the right will support him if he's clever. They're not going to support him. They're very much about what they're about, and they're smart people. I mean, I don't like their politics, but you have to say that they have an agenda. They know who their friends are. They stay with it. They accuse us of not being bipartisan when they are the most partisan people on the face of the earth. They're clever, and Obama's not going to trick them. His domesticating the left is probably the greatest mistake he could have made, and that's what's happened. But it's only happened in the Beltway. It hasn't happened in America. It has not happened in America, and I think that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin. I think that's what we're seeing in Ohio and in California and New York and all the places where there's, you know, brave acts of a protest every day. And we want to let everyone know that you're not alone, that the nurses throughout America stand with you, that we're very unhappy with the politics and the policies of this country that don't allow people to have health care, where they have to worry about if what they're going to eat, if they'll have a home, where banks are actually more powerful. I mean, the Obama administration has made the banking industry more powerful instead of less powerful. Ultimately, we've created a Goliath of insurmountable size. We want a very different America, and we want an America that's based on what we consider to be nursing values, which are caring, compassion, and community. And that is not the direction of this country. It's greed. It's Wall Street. It's bailing out the banking industry, bailing out Wall Street. Well, as a matter of fact, nurses are in every community in this country, and they see the human suffering, and they see that there's no safety net for people, and they're going to stand up, and they're going to organize throughout this country. And I think our protest is just a vehicle. Our protest Twitter, and then we'll have a website, and we're going to have a lot of other things to go with this. But it'll be a place where people can come, see what's going on, join what's going on, put up what's going on that they're doing in their own community, and to let everyone know that they're not alone.
Sounds like you're going to put together a progressive central.
You know, really, people are just like, thank goodness. I mean, even, you know, like even major newspapers are actually noting it, which is kind of stunning. The corporate media would very much like to ignore us, and the Internet has actually given us a new weapon. And I think that we're going to have mass communication on this, and I think it's going to pick up steam very, very quickly. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. So I want to, like, once again, give it a plug, protestintheusa.com, and for people to post their protest and to go to the Twitter, to sign up on the Twitter, and to receive what's going on, you know, on a daily basis throughout this country. And hopefully we'll let everyone know that, you know, this fight for human dignity is an international fight, and we're fighting for that in America as well.
So we're going to see an end to boutique kind of protest and a broader-based sharing of the not just the misery, but the solutions and the actions.
Absolutely, absolutely. So information can be powerful. We're going to shine a light on what's really actually happening in terms of the underbelly of America, but also in terms of the hope of America, which is actually the unity of working people throughout this country.
Am I taking too much license to interpret that part of the inspiration was the observation of so many different sectors of Egyptian society coming together during that amazing 18 days?
You know, the truth of the matter is we were going to do this. Obviously, the Egyptian protests, we had already had the domain and had the Twitter account and everything, but the Egyptian protests were absolutely an inspiration, because if people can protest in Egypt, when you figure that the decline of the standard of the American, which is a very different standard, but the decline of the living standard in America, you know, these are relative, right? And that kind of, if they can do that in Egypt and take the risk that they would incur, then surely we can do that in America.
Rose Ann DeMauro of National Nurses United. President Obama wants to slash half of the funding for Community Action Block Grants, a program begun under President Johnson as part of the 1960s War on Poverty. The cuts include money for Head Start, job training, health, nutrition, and energy conservation. This on top of Obama's plan to cut home heating oil for the poor in half. Brett Warnke is a Rhode Island-based writer whose recent article in Counterpunch magazine is entitled Obama's Onslaught on Community Action.
I think that this is a huge betrayal of his natural constituency. This is something only a liberal Democrat could do, it seems. Republicans have tried to cut community action funds for decades, but it looks like Obama will be the one to do it. And the irony of this is a guy who was a community action organizer, a community organizer for 3 years during the unsentimental Reagan years. You know, he writes about this in his book, The Audacity of Hope. He talks about laboring in obscurity. And here we have him, 2 years in, working on slashing or eliminating 200 programs, slashing $2.5 billion from that heating assistance program and $300 million from this community services block grant. It's a scandal.
And let's talk about what kind of community organizer he was. There are many different kinds of community organizers, but he was one who pointed community groups towards these specific community action funds that were available for various projects. Now, when future community activists try to do the same thing, the funds won't be there.
Absolutely. And this is not some left-wing project. I mean, these are programs that educate people, have GED programs or Head Start programs. They offer sexual abuse and counseling, sexual abuse counseling to people. I was talking to a woman the other day, this lady named Suzanne. She's 49 years old. She's in a GED program. Community Action was teaching her how to pay her taxes. And if you talk to any of these Community Action leaders, they'll tell you, what is the goal? It's to make people self-sufficient, to give people basic necessities like food and heat. I mean, this is not, you know, some radical project. This is the safety net. When you talk about the safety net, the floor below which no one will fall, this is it. And this is what President Obama is cutting. Not only is he cutting this is the sole program in which he mentioned in the State of the Union that he would cut. And the truly upsetting thing about this is he didn't bother to tell the community action organizations that he would do this. David Bradley, who is basically the lobbyist in chief for these community action programs, was sitting in the gallery and had no clue that this former community organizer would be singling out his program for the butcher's block.
Well, doesn't that in fact tell the political story of Obama? That is, different constituencies are prepared, are primed to resist cuts when there is a George Bush senior or a junior at the helm, but are unprepared and flabbergasted when the attack comes from the black Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see people shocked at this, but not apparently as many people as we would hope. I mean, I was doing some searching before we spoke on who is talking about this. Luckily, the Huffington Post is writing about this, and, you know, you might see some minor coverage, but shouldn't there be more outrage on the left?
Well, one would think that there would be outrage throughout the universe of black elected urban officials who deal with these community block grants all the time.
Well, it's interesting you say that. There was a U.S. Conference of Mayors that submitted a letter because basically 100 metro areas throughout the country are projecting double-digit unemployment in the upcoming years. And they wrote a letter to President Obama saying, look, this is serious stuff. I mean, these programs create jobs. They leverage economic development. They build infrastructure in our cities. These promote home ownership. They support things like energy improvements, social services to local governments. This is not something you play around with.
Yes, and in fact, as I remember being a local reporter, this is the arena, in fact, in which different community groups compete.
Yeah, I'm glad you spoke about that word competition, because this is the most frightening thing of all. If this plan that Jacob Lew alluded to goes forward, where community action agencies, about 1,000 throughout the country, will be competing for funds in a race to the top-like measure, you will see what basically would be a regionalization of programs. I mean, think of who would lose in this situation where you have agencies competing against each other. Who's going to be the loser? It's going to be places in the suburbs. It's going to be places in rural areas. And the people who will have the strength here is metropolitan areas. And you'll have pooling of resources and regionalization and a withering in some of the hardest hit areas from this recession.
And one can also see political fratricide as groups that used to collaborate find themselves fighting each other tooth and nail for a dwindling community block pie.
Absolutely. You'll see competition. I mean, there are many good groups whose budgets and finances are solid, who do great work, but they'll be competing for those same federal funds. There's blood in the water right now. And, you know, I mean, you can imagine the situation. Who does someone on the left turn to when Obama is proposing these cuts? I mean, you have that creepy little puke from Utah saying he's going to filibuster the debt ceiling measure. You have Newt Gingrich pledging to take the country back to 1931. This is an old strategy. You have the right wing move so far to the right that anything moderate liberals will do seems radical. So it's a desperate situation for people who are progressive right now.
Apologists for Obama will say the devil made me do it, the GOP devil. But as you pointed out, Obama signaled quite clearly that he was going after the community block grants very early on.
He preempted them. I mean, clearly they're asking for more cuts in community action. They're asking for, you know, a double cut. I think it's $400 million to the community services block grant. I don't have the figures. But this is part of the problem with the way President Obama thinks about politics. I mean, again, in his book, Audacity of Hope, he said our democracy is not a house to be built, but a conversation to be had. I mean, a conversation. I'd like to see him and Mitch McConnell have a conversation about these cuts. What will that look like? It's going to be interesting.
Now, as you said, many people are not conversant with the term community block grants, but actually this program represents the residue of the Great Society, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a program from the early 60s that has done extraordinary work for 50 years. Just recently, Sergeant Shriver died, and he was kind of the lodestar for the community action programs. David Bradley was his protege, and now he's, like I said, their lobbyist-in-chief in Washington, D.C. One wonders why on earth he didn't know that these cuts were coming. But, yeah, since the 60s, community action programs have been local grassroots organizations working with communities that are hard struck. I mean, I live in Rhode Island. There's a city called Woonsocket with 25% unemployment. What do you do with 25% unemployment? You're going to have help. You're going to have that net we're talking about, and that's what community action provides.
So, under Barack Obama's watch, we may be finally seeing the death knell of the old war on poverty.
This could be the case, yeah. I think, again, if you look at what the man said before he was running for office, and it gives you hints to where he's being pushed. I mean, he said in his book, I serve as a blank screen on which people of vastly different political stripes project their own views. So when liberals saw him, they saw hope and change. And what we're getting now is a president who's asking for cuts in programs that he considered top 10 performers. I mean, go to the White House website. Look up community action programs. These are programs that were given billions in stimulus funds and efficiently, energetically spent these monies for programs like weatherization, programs like heating oil and fuel assistance in the winter. just recently, Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts wrote a letter condemning these cuts and saying, look, we're having a terrible winter here. We need this help. We can't make these cuts, as you said in your State of the Union, on the backs of the most vulnerable. But it looks like that's what Obama plans to do.
And do you expect there to be enough pushback from Democrats to head this off?
No, I don't. There'll be grumbling. I think there'll be many letters and posturing. But in the end, I don't think that they're going to challenge this. Because, again, they're threatened by what the right will do. And Obama, like Clinton in the 90s, can say, who are you going to run to?
That was Brett Warnke speaking from Providence, Rhode Island. Some employers refuse to hire anybody who is currently unemployed. Last week, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission held hearings to decide what to do about the practice. One of those who testified was Dr. Algernon Austin of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. We asked Dr. Austin if employers that don't hire the unemployed are breaking any laws.
Well, that's what the hearing was to determine, and it's really there's the legal question of, you know, where does this fall within law? And the hearing was to try to figure out, you know, does it violate our current laws? You know, is there a disparate impact? Are protected groups going to be disproportionately hurt? But I think it's, on the broader sense of a civil rights issue, it is something that we should be seriously concerned about, because people of color are more likely to be unemployed, and are therefore more likely to be subject to exclusion from employment because they are currently unemployed. And, you know, blacks are about twice as likely to be unemployed as whites, and Latinos are about 1.5 times as likely to be unemployed as whites. So if employers are doing that, engaging in this practice, it'll be, in my view, will disproportionately harm, you know, blacks and Latinos and American Indians, who also have a high unemployment rate relative to whites.
This kind of practice would deepen into the structure those divisions by race that already exist, wouldn't they?
Yes. We have these large unemployment disparities, and for blacks, you know, we can track them precisely back to the 70s. So this would just worsen the situation, yes, because with the Great Recession, the black unemployment rate is almost 16%. So a significant, if this becomes a routine and widespread practice, a significant segment of the black population that's currently unemployed is at the risk of being, you know, excluded possibly forever.
This sounds like an outrageous case of blaming the victim, of seeming to cast aspersions on one's character because one is unemployed.
Yes. It's hard to understand why an employer would do this. There are some people who have negative views of people who are unemployed and blame the victim and assume that if you're unemployed, there's something wrong with you. But of course, if you just look carefully around, you know that we're still trying to get out of the greatest economic decline that we've experienced since the Great Recession. So it's just, we have a horrible economy that we're trying, that produce a large number of unemployed people. It's really, when I heard about this, I was shocked and surprised, and I hope that the EEOC and others really communicate to employers that they need to stop this practice if they're engaging in it. One thing that people said is that for some employers or employment sort of job placement agencies, that they might just be using it because they're being overwhelmed with job applications. You know, they advertise a job and they get a thousand resumes, and this might be one tool that they're using just to whittle that 1,000 down to 200 or something. The EEOC and others really need to make it clear to employers that that's not an acceptable way of dealing with a lot of job applications.
counselors and others are constantly telling people, especially long-term unemployed people, that it's not their fault, that they shouldn't feel that they're to blame for their condition. And yet now we hear that employers are saying, yes, it is. It is your fault, and we're not going to hire you.
This is a massive downturn. There are millions and millions of people who are unemployed. This is not any individual's fault. This is a major disruption in the American economy.
Also at those EEOC hearings was Christina Owens, Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project. Ms. Owens' organization gathered some of the information that prompted the federal agency's interest. We asked her if there's any hard data on the practice of blacklisting the unemployed.
There's not a formal survey or formal report that documents exactly what the frequency or incidence of this practice is. What we have are examples of advertisements and job postings online or on online job posting websites that include language that says anything from only currently employed workers should apply to will not consider unemployed workers regardless of the reason. So we have a number of examples of those exclusions, but we really don't know what the actual incidence is. And of course, there's really no way to know outside the context of these advertisements how many employers or staffing firms may informally use such a screening device without actually explicitly stating that they're doing so.
For more than the last 40 years, black unemployment rates have been roughly double that of whites. We usually talk about those figures in terms of institutional racism. If this is, in fact, a widespread practice, aren't we talking about an employment practice that deepens institutional racism?
Absolutely. There's no question about that, that if part of why unemployment rates are so much higher among African Americans is because there is this racism at work that operates to keep them out of jobs in the first instance, then that the problems are compounded when unemployed workers are not considered for jobs.
Some apologists for employers say, well, there's a deluge of applications. People have to use some kind of mechanism to wade through the flood of paper. Is that a valid excuse?
No, it's not. I mean, what it means is that many people who are qualified for the job are not going to be considered for the jobs, and it means that there may well be an impact that falls more harshly on people of color because of higher unemployment rates, or on older unemployed workers who are more likely to experience longer durations of unemployment. There certainly are lots of job applications for every job, but that doesn't mean that it's okay to take shortcuts that arbitrarily screen out people who are otherwise qualified except for the fact that they are not currently working.
Doesn't this tend to send a message to people who are unemployed that their fears were well-founded?
I think absolutely. You know, I think a lot of folks, unfortunately, feel stigmatized already by the fact that they're unemployed, and that's unfair. It's not their fault that they've lost their jobs. This economy is chewing up jobs and spitting out workers. It's happening to millions of people. But then to have insult added to injury by being told you're not going to be considered for a job because you have the misfortune of being unemployed just deepens that stigmatizing.
That was Christina Owens of the National Employment Law Project. Wall Street seems to operate under laws of its own. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, says we're in the midst of the worst scandal in human history.
If we could ever wake up Washington so that they would start going after the frauds, we would have thousands of financial markets people being prosecuted and many, many of them would go to jail.
But if you have a criminal conspiracy that is so pervasive and so inherently locked into the political system, how can we expect a federal or state investigatory project to propose effective countermeasures?
everyone asks this question, and I admit it is extremely difficult. Let me just say two things. First, the saving and loan crisis was the last time we saw in the U.S. really widespread fraud and criminal conspiracies. The saving and loan sector was taken over by crooks. They committed fraud, and they got away with it for a while. But eventually, the government did go after them, imprisoned 1,000 top management officials from the savings and loan. They served jail time. We did go after them. They were very well-connected people. Savings and loans help out the local politicians, I mean congressmen. Often they finance their homes. They give them special deals. And the Congress people are beholden to savings and loans. So it was difficult to go after them. And remember, Keating, the Keating Five, including John McCain, he bought 5 senators. Okay, this is a very important guy. He went to prison. So we have done it before. The second thing that I would add to that is that state attorneys generals are going after the frauds. They are starting to prosecute these guys. And Washington is going to get awfully embarrassed that you have 50 states going after the frauds, and Washington is just sitting on its hands. I think that the Obama administration is going to be pushed, probably kicking and screaming, to go after some of these guys.
Well, we've just seen the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and its report. Does that report give you any optimism?
Yeah, it does. They really want Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Let's sort of forget out all the bad behavior in the past and let's move forward. I think that the report does identify many of the problems, the majority part of the report anyway. The minority part of the report is a real hoot to read because these guys are just trying to justify all of the stuff that conservatives in Washington pushed through. I think there's a lot of good stuff in the report, and the report really does name names. I mean, okay, it says that the captains of finance plus the supposedly public stewards in Washington caused this crisis. It was completely preventable. It was foreseen. These people knew what was going on. They knew it was going to create a catastrophe. There is no question whatsoever about this. And we're talking about Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, Bob Rubin, Henry Paulson. They caused the crisis.
And you've been speaking of a criminal conspiracy, and they caused the crisis. Are they part of the criminal conspiracy?
Okay, now, criminal conspiracy has to be proven in court. I am saying that individually, these guys caused the crisis. That conspiracy, we're going to have to see that proven in court. That is a much harder thing to prove.
And you express confidence that ultimately Obama will be moved, kicking and screaming, to do something about it. But then you named basically some of his, well, not some of his top economic officials as being culprits.
It's not just me. The report names them. The report says these guys did it, and that's right. Bernanke and Geithner are still there, and they are still shoveling funds to Wall Street to try to bail out their buddies.
And how much money did they shovel to Wall Street, essentially? How many trillions?
Well, it's very hard to get an exact number on this, in part because most of what they did was behind closed doors. When Congress asked them what they had done, they refused to tell Congress. Now, just fairly recently, the Fed has released a lot of details on the asset purchases that they made. They bought a lot of toxic waste from the biggest financial institutions, and now that data is being released. But that's only part of what they did, because they also lent a lot of funds and they also guaranteed a lot of the assets on the books of the biggest banks. Anyway, estimates run up above $20 trillion that was either spent, lent, or guaranteed by Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam is on the hook for something like $20 trillion in order to save Wall Street.
Do we have any statutes on the books that deal with crimes, if those are crimes, that huge?
Well, yeah, I believe so. We have laws against defrauding your customers. We know that the financial institutions did that. We have consumer protection laws. Public officials, it's a little bit harder to prosecute them. I'm no lawyer, but just being incompetent isn't a crime. It's a good reason for firing them. The Fed does have a lot of latitude in what it does behind closed doors. I hope Congress will change that as a result of this crisis. So I'm not sure we could say that these asset purchases or the loans made behind closed doors would be illegal. It sure stinks.
How can the people be made whole?
Well, that's going to be very, very tough. The crisis wiped out $11 trillion of household wealth. That is a huge amount. It's almost as big as our whole nation's GDP. The projections are that 13 million people are going to lose their homes because of this crisis, because of what Wall Street did. That is going to take a very long time to recover from. We'll measure that not in years. It's going to be a decade before real estate will come back, because there are just so many homes on the market and that will go into the market. So many people who've lost their life savings, the equity that they had in their homes. They were defrauded by unscrupulous mortgage brokers who induced them to refinance their homes into mortgages they couldn't possibly afford. So recovering from that is going to take a long time. We've got something like 26 million people who either have lost their jobs, they're counted as unemployment, who have had to take hour cuts or forced to take on part-time jobs because they couldn't find full-time jobs, or who gave up looking altogether and they're now counted as out of the labor force. 26 million people because of this crisis who can't get full-time work. No one believes that even if we are in an economic recovery, which I don't believe, even if we are, they're all saying it's going to take years for the unemployment rate to come down to 5 or 6%. So, again, a very long time to recover from this.
And, of course, by any measurement, Black America has been hit proportionately worse than most other constituencies of the country, and yet there are those who continue to say that the crisis was caused by lending money to Black folks to buy homes.
That is just ridiculous. I know that the Glenn Becks try to claim that the government forced banks to make loans to minorities as part of the Community Reinvestment Act, CRA. Everyone who has looked at this seriously comes to the same conclusion. Completely false. It never happened. It's a right-wing fantasy. The mortgage brokers are not subject to CRA at all, only banks. And the number of banks that did not meet CRA and therefore actually were pushed by the government to do anything was less than a handful. It's just insignificant. Finally, CRA has been around for a couple of decades. The crisis, it happened in the past 7 or 8 years. So it just makes no sense. On Black Americans, yes, their unemployment rate officially is usually about double that for the nation as a whole. So when unemployment goes up, the Black unemployment goes up twice as much. And, of course, the official unemployment rates don't count. At least half of the people who are jobless. So the official rates vastly undercount the number of black Americans. By any measure, this is a great depression for black Americans in terms of unemployment.
Professor Randall Ray is author of the book Understanding Modern Money. The United Nations has named 2011 the International Year for People of African Descent, or IPAD for short. In Chicago, black activists have scheduled a year of organizing around the theme of human rights. Cam Howard is a spokesman for the Committee for People of African Descent of Chicago.
We comprise the ad hoc committee of pan-African and national organizations here in the city of Chicago. I have a long track record of struggling for the same theme that the International Year has proposed, recognition, justice, and development. We began by stating our intention, which is to educate, mobilize, and organize people of African descent in Chicago using the IPAD banner for the right of to promote the right of self-determination. So that will be the theme of most of the events that we do, and we will highlight Malcolm X's thoughts and actions regarding our efforts on the international level.
That's quite interesting, because Malcolm is usually credited with bringing to the forefront the need to take black demands in the United States before an international tribunal.
That is correct. I want to highlight that. So we seem to be coming full circle, or we're going to utilize this year to attempt to manifest some of Malcolm's instructions.
The United Nations designated this as a special year, but how does that designation, since you've been carrying on this kind of work all year, every year, how does that designation facilitate your program?
Well, it allows us to all the various organizations get on one page to come to some type of unity and purpose, and also to blend what we're doing. For instance, the All African People's Revolutionary Party puts on an African Liberation Day event every year, and they include other organizations. But now this allows for the IPAD committee to actually actively engage in assisting them in their efforts and mobilizing the people to come out to the event so that awareness can be raised. Also, what it allows us to do by the UN putting the recognition, it allows us to bring this issue mainstream to many of our brothers and sisters who I'm not human rights educated. It allows us to bring the whole human rights discussion into the mainstream of African people. So we know we've been focused on civil rights struggle for the last 40 years, and that has ran its course. And so it allows us to open up. And anytime the quote-unquote establishment authorizes or says it's okay to talk about something, and it bodes well for us who have been trying to get this conversation out for a long time.
Well, what's the difference between the way groups in IPAD look at human rights and the way, well, let's say, George Bush looked at human rights? Everybody seems to be for human rights these days.
People of IPAD, people of African descent, we have been to victims of human rights violations for 40 years or more. When the United States government looks at human rights, they do so from an internal lens of even seeing it through a civil rights individual lens, as opposed to what we see it as a group lens. We see ourselves as a nation within a nation, and look at our human rights violations as group violations. As opposed to individual violations, which this country doesn't recognize the group violations of our rights as people.
So black folks' struggle for self-determination is a human rights struggle.
It is definitely a human rights struggle. Dr. Cly reminds us, and peace be upon the brother, he's just deceased, Dr. Wayne Cly. He informed us that under international law, there are primarily three types of minorities. You have the subgroup minority, which is a subgroup of the majority. In the case of the United States, some subgroup minorities would be white women, the gay and lesbian community, Democrat, Republican, et cetera. And subgroup minorities' rights are civil in nature, their individual rights, and their civil in nature. The second group of minorities under international law would be the immigrant minority. The immigrant minority is, of course, a minority who voluntarily immigrates to a particular country. Their rights are also civil in nature, their individual rights. They are expected to assimilate into the country in which they immigrate to. And then the third group of minorities are, according to Dr. Clyde, national minorities. National minorities are minorities who are in a particular country at the time the country was formed, and they were instrumental in the development of the country. As such, national minorities' rights are human in nature, they are group rights, and they are expected, or they can declare that they want to maintain their own cultural personality. There are three national minorities in America. There are the Native Americans who were here at the founding of this country, and whose land was an integral component of the development of this country. Then there were African Americans. We are a national minority. We were here at the founding of this country, and of course our labor was instrumental in the development of this country. And then there's the Chicanos of Southwest America when their land was annexed or stolen during the Mexican-American Wars. They are the other national minorities. So all Latinos are not national minorities, they're immigrant minorities. And so when we loop ourselves as band of subgroup minorities in America, we give up a whole set of rights that we can assert that right of self-determination to maintain a separate, even within this country, a separate sovereignty and all the things that self-determination covers. So we have the rights by international law, we just haven't asserted them. And so this allows us to have this discussion, this whole discussion of sovereignty and self-determination.
This worldview clashes dramatically with that of Barack Obama, who said famously in 2004, there is no Hispanic America, there is no Black America, there is only the United States of America.
This clash, his view clashes with international law. What he is proclaiming then is that we, all national minorities, must assimilate, which under international law is a valid human right. It is a declaring of, it is actually a statement of ethnocide. If you're saying that all ethnic minorities or national minorities must assimilate, then that is under U.S. law, under international law, a statement of a position of ethnocide if that is attempted to be forced or a program is carried out to make that happen. So that statement in itself is a violation of international law. We here in Chicago will host, as part of our IPAD, in conjunction with our IPAD efforts is we're going to be the host city of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations 22nd Annual National Conference in June 24th through the 26th of this year. And our theme is Bambalela Tarishi. We would never give up. Be prepared for reparations now. And we're going to focus on self-determination as reparation, the fight for autonomous control of these social institutions and institutions that affect our daily life as a struggle in the reparations movement.
That was Cam Howard speaking from Chicago. In Washington, Black Agenda Reports' Dr. Jared Ball looks at the black condition through the lens of critical race theory.
In his Washington Post column last week, Courtland Malloy made an interesting point. He was talking about the economic levee break that is currently washing away millions of our homes and jobs, when he also noted how much attention was going to the recent uprising in Egypt. He was quick to remind us that we have a Cairo of our own, he said, a little town in Illinois where the unemployment rate is more than 14% and 33% of its residents live below the poverty line. I don't think it should be taken as a lack of solidarity as much as a warning, as he said, that we had better wise up. And I think that what we still have to wise up to is the underlying point, one made by critical race theorists, that a fundamental anti-blackness in this country demands the continuing inequities and also demands that they go unnoticed or improperly understood. Better to focus on the more distant effects of this nation's policies than on those right here. Because no one in Malloy's D.C. has forgotten the last time 2 million black people showed up, and that wasn't even a revolution. George Taylor once described the work of critical race theorists as recognizing how this society sees whiteness as a property right, which is an essential element of American, that is white, social stability. Whiteness as a property right. The point has been made many times, but in this particular phrasing and in this particular time, it seems even more appropriate. If we see whiteness as a property, we also see its necessary opposite, the absence of access, or the absence of black opportunity for ownership. And if property, be it whiteness or any other form, is essential to social stability, it also means that black access to property is anathema to the social order. There is a permanency here which demands and explains the hyper-attention paid to Egypt and the absence of attention paid to similar kinds of suffering here in the United States, particularly among black people. This also has real material impact. So, for instance, reports from last month show that home loss is increasing nationwide and that foreclosure rates will eventually surpass those of 2010. According to one analyst, the sea change we are seeing is not a reduction in home loss, but a shift in the cause from bad loans to unemployment and economic displacement. It is why Malloy also noted that the nation's richest black community, Prince George's County, Maryland, is also home to the highest black foreclosure rate. Even the best off can't save themselves. But this is not simply about black inferiority in money management. The reasons reach far deeper into the recesses of this nation's history and culture than most realize or can allow themselves to conceive. Consider the work of Georgetown University law professor Emma Coleman Jordan. During her 2009 address to the 14th annual Derrick Bell Lecture on Race in American Society, this critical race theorist explained the current home foreclosure rate crisis in terms of what she calls this nation's algorithm of inequality. Jordan, performing her own critical race theory, explains the foundation of these foreclosures in similar terms and is clear that they are not at the root of this most recent financial crisis despite popular claim. No, Jordan explains that the issue is a crisis born out of African America's original crisis, enslavement and the redevelopment of humanity. She points to 1865 and explains that the idea of home ownership has for black people been about what she calls the psychic dividing line between slavery and freedom. Home and land ownership is what for the formerly enslaved represented a free and human identity. Add to that decades of myth development, the myth of home ownership as the key component to civilized participation in society, and you have what Jordan describes as a perfect storm of susceptibility to the contractual trapdoors beneath a noose of predatory lending terms. Decades of propaganda followed by intense target marketing of subprime loans to black people, and voila, $200 billion in lost wealth. Cortland Malloy suggests in his piece, facetiously or not, that black people scatter into integrated neighborhoods where foreclosures are less likely to occur or where black people are less likely to be targeted for them. On the other hand, Jordan's solutions, while less pragmatic, are ultimately more substantial. She argues that we need to see these crises as a violent result of an ideology which results in economic and social policies predetermined to this effect. If we do not challenge this anti-black and anti-human ideological structure, we will remain persistently atop trapdoors beneath nooses.
Dr. Jared Ball of Black Agenda Report. The fight against so-called prison gerrymandering is one of the few bright spots on the reform scene. The goal is to count prison inmates as residents of their home cities, rather than using inmates to boost the political power of the small towns and counties where they're incarcerated. Peter Wagner heads up the Prison Policy Initiative.
In the last year, we've had a number of tremendous changes, one very subtle thing and then a number that are very visible and exciting. The subtle thing is it was too late for the Census Bureau to even consider changing where they were going to count people in prison. But they're going to, in May, release the prison count data early. So the redistricting data is coming out in the next few weeks. But for the first time, states and counties are going to have the ability to know for sure when they see a district, they're going to be able to know for sure, is that a prison population in that district? So that's number one. Number two that's very exciting is that three states, Maryland, Delaware, and New York, have all passed legislation. They're going to figure out where incarcerated people come from, and they're going to adjust the federal census data and draw districts on the basis of people being counted at home. And then the third thing is that there's been this tremendous outpouring of support from the bottom up. that's really kind of said that prison-based gerrymandering needs to end. And some of the key organizations that have been doing this is the NAACP at their annual convention for the third year in a row had a very strong resolution against prison-based gerrymandering. And the National Black Caucus of State Legislators at their meeting at the end of December has a resolution that's condemning prison-based gerrymandering and encouraging other states to follow the lead of Delaware, Maryland, and New York in passing laws to end prison-based gerrymandering, and they're calling on the Census Bureau to end the practice. So there's been this tremendous groundswell of support that's really put prison-based gerrymandering on the agenda. Now, redistricting is about to start in every state. Not every state is going to be able to or possible to pass laws like Delaware, Maryland, and New York did, but it's really kind of incumbent upon us to raise the issue of prison-based gerrymandering now so that if we can't get it fixed now, at the very least we make sure that it never happens again.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you BlackAgendaReport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford. My colleague, Nellie Bailey, will return next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.